Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Protesters on the no indictment of Officer Daniel Pantaleo back after the killing of the death of Eric Garner in police custody in 2014. And we start this morning with the latest chapter in the push for justice in the death of Eric Garner, almost 5 years after he died while being arrested for selling cigarettes on Staten Island. The officer, Daniel Pantaleo, who placed Garner in the chokehold that led to his death, or he argues that, Pantaleo argues that only contributed to his death and legitimately, is now in his NYPD disciplinary trial. A big revelation came on Thursday. Gasps could be heard in the courtroom when text messages between a police commander and an officer in the field were read aloud. The exchange revealed that when a police commander received word that Garner was likely, quote, dead on arrival following the arrest, he responded with a text that said, "Not a big deal." Here's Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, responding to that new piece of information.
"This is something that I had not heard before. That when the call came in that the person may be DOA, and he says, not a big deal. That means he's talking about our community is not a big deal. But we are going to make it a big deal. We're going to be out there on the front line, and it is a big deal. That was my son. And he was a big deal to me. Not only big inside, he was my big deal."
Gwen Carr, Eric Garner's mother, at a National Action Network rally in Harlem on Saturday. Now, this disciplinary proceeding is not a criminal trial, and it only comes after a Staten Island grand jury declined to indict Pantaleo on any crimes in 2014, as I mentioned before. And as far as we know, federal charges are no longer coming, although incredibly, the U.S. Justice Department has never issued a decision one way or another. We heard Garner's mother in that clip say that she had never heard about those text messages. We're going to talk about the latest in the trial, and we'll also discuss why transparency is such a big hurdle in police conduct investigations. Mara Gay is with us, New York Times editorial board member, and Phil Stinson, professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and a police misconduct expert. Mara, welcome back. Phil, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Mara, let's take that explosive text message revelation first. No big deal. Not a big deal. The way they're defending it is that the commander presumed that the officers in the field would be shaken by the death of somebody in their custody, and he was trying to reassure them that since they were making a lawful arrest, they didn't have to worry about themselves.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem. In addition to just showing a lack of professionalism and a lack of common decency, not a big deal, that's the sentiment that, you know, every black person in America fears that a police officer is thinking when he or she comes across, you know, yourself or himself or herself or their kids. I mean, that is the fear, and that is the history. And given the context of what actually happened to Eric Garner and the justice that didn't come afterwards, that one sentence speaks volumes.
The head of the police union, Patrick Lynch, says what came after exactly proves why the commander felt an impulse to say not a big deal to the officers on the scene, because one who's a police officer could have predicted that there would be a huge public outcry whether or not they did anything wrong.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I have actually a lot of sympathy for the police, because it's a tough job, and in some ways it's a thankless job. And it's hard to make decisions in the split moment when life and death is at stake. The problem is that the NYPD is an agency that is not held accountable when something does go wrong. And that is what sends the wrong message. It's not necessarily that we have tons of killer cops, as some of the activists might say. I don't agree with that personally. I don't think that's the issue. I think most of them are extremely professional. But some of the incentives are wrong. I mean, this was an operation, we also learned last week, against Eric Garner. That was part of an operation to heavily police quality of life offenses, including the selling of Lucy's. And that's been part of the larger conversation in this city. And it's an important one to have, because this is not an encounter that should have ended in anyone's death.
Phil Stinson, for you as a criminologist and police misconduct expert, what was your reaction when you first heard about that text message? How rare or not rare would something like that be?
Well, I think with all of this, in terms of transparency, the one thing that we are getting out of it is each thing that comes out through this disciplinary trial is learning a little bit more, peeling a little bit more back against the curtain of the police subculture. And I think that's what we have here. But in terms of not a big deal, if you think about it, if we start to aggregate the data across the country, and keeping in mind that we have more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies all across the country, if we were just to limit to deaths by police officers as a result of fatal police shootings, we now know that between 900 and 1,000 times each and every year across the country, on-duty police officers shoot and kill someone. So that's two, three, four times a day across the country. And that's just the shootings. People die in police custody every day across this country. And I think, from the perspective of a police supervisor, one way to look at it is, well, that's not a big deal. These things happen. To somebody who's not in law enforcement, and to many, I think, who are in law enforcement, you hear that and you just cringe, though, because it is a big deal.
Listeners, we can take your phone calls if you've been following the trial of Officer Daniel Pantaleo. Of course, there are no cameras in the courtroom, no microphones in the courtroom, but if you've been reading and hearing and watching press accounts or some of the individuals close to it who've been reacting, give us your thoughts, give us your questions. For Mara Gay from the New York Times editorial board, and Phil Stinson, professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He is a police misconduct expert. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. The prosecution has rested, and the defense just started this week going through their case. So we're kind of at the midway point right now. Obviously, we'll talk about it again when it's over, but we're doing a kind of midway assessment. And listeners, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Mara, that text message, I think, swamped everything else that was reported about the trial last week. But there were other pretty bombshell pieces of testimony. There was a medical examiner who talked about the death being consistent with a chokehold. There was also the head of training from the NYPD for new recruits who talked about it being inconsistent with the training. Can you talk about either of those things?
Yeah, sure. Just to talk about the training for a moment, part of the defense for Officer Pantaleo is that he wasn't using a chokehold, but was actually using something called a seatbelt maneuver. And then we had an instructor testify last week saying that actually showing Pantaleo never would have been taught that maneuver in his training, and that it wasn't used at the time. You know, I would say one of the biggest bombshells last week that we learned was actually that the internal investigation very quickly after the death in 2014 into Eric Garner's death actually showed that Officer Pantaleo was at fault, and it recommended disciplinary charges against the officer. Those never came. Now, the mayor and his two police commissioners that have served him had said for years at this point that they were waiting for the outcome of a federal DOJ investigation. It is true that the Department of Justice, according to my reporting, did ask them as a courtesy to do that early on. But I think that's been used First of all, there was no requirement to do so. Secondly, that was years ago. The feds, I think, would have understood the urgency in taking an officer like this off the force, or at least bringing disciplinary hearings against him. And I think that, you know, the mayor owes the city and owes the Garner family an explanation.
You mentioned the defense being used, that it was not actually a chokehold. Here's a clip of Officer Pantaleo's lawyer, Stuart London, arguing that it was not a chokehold, despite what it looks to the looks like to the average person in the video footage.
Interesting. The trachea was intact. The hyoid bone was intact. The larynx was intact. There was no cartilage damage. I submit it wasn't a chokehold at all. It may have looked like a chokehold when you slow it down frame by frame.
So, Professor Stinson, again, as a criminologist and a police misconduct expert, how do you view the videotape?
Well, it's clear that Officer Pantaleo's actions resulted in the death of Eric Garner, so they can call it what they want to call it, but the facts remain the same. The problem I think that I have is that the whole idea of this disciplinary trial, it makes it look like it's a criminal trial, at least to the context of having prosecutors, defense attorneys, you've got an administrative law judge. But keep in mind, the judge in this trial cannot render a verdict. That would go to the police commissioner to decide what discipline will be imposed, if any, and we may not learn that. That may not become public.
Right, and that will put it back in the court of the police commissioner, Mara, and
yes,
even the mayor, because this trial, it's a community, civilian complaint review board trial, so it's not in the judicial system. It's within this particular system in or adjacent to the NYPD, and whatever it finds, guilt or innocence or however they describe it, is only advisory, right?
Yeah, so it is. That's right. It is only advisory. It's an NYPD departmental trial. The charges were brought by the Civilian Complaint Review Board. The police commissioner will have the ultimate say. But of course, let's not forget that the police commissioner is appointed by and overseen theoretically by the mayor. I mean, I actually want to go back for just a moment to this issue of the attorney for the officer, Stuart London, talking about the trachea. First of all, I'm not a doctor. Neither is he. And I did sit and listen to the medical examiner's testimony. Eric Garner was bleeding from his eyes, bleeding, hemorrhaging in his throat as he died. Blood vessels were bursting as because he was being essentially strangled to death. And the medical examiner was actually asked whether the trachea, for example, needs to be crushed in all cases of strangulation. And you know, she said, actually, no, it's fairly common. That if an arm, for example, is being used, as Officer Pantaleo's arm was, which is a soft object, that his trachea wouldn't necessarily be crushed, even though his airway was restricted. So I think, you know, Stuart London is trying to do his job, but I think that what people saw in that video is exactly what happened. And that's, you know, that may sound obvious, but we've heard a lot of spin from the city and the police department for the past 5 years. And it turned out to be just that spin.
Let's take a phone call. Tom in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I keep hearing about these cases of police trying to subdue someone with a taser or chokeholds or stuff like this. And I'm wondering, why hasn't something been developed? And I know this sounds crazy, but like a net or something where you can just subdue someone until everybody calms down and just wait it out. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Stinson, what would your answer to Tom be?
Well, I think there are such devices, but when we look at any sort of less lethal device, there are risks. We now know, for example, with the taser, which is a form of a conductive energy device that's very popular with law enforcement agencies across the country and elsewhere across the world, that it's not as effective as the manufacturer would have us believe. I read a study recently that I think about 53-56% of the deployments of the taser, where they actually deploy the taser on someone, actually have the effect that's desired by the officers so that they can restrain someone. There's a lot of risk. People die from the use of tasers.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Rick in Dobbs Ferry. You're on WNYC. Hi, Rick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wonder if there's just an expectation from police officers that their conduct shouldn't be questioned, that in general they may feel that they're doing a hard job. And I remember when Mayor de Blasio was first elected, he had said something, I'm not sure of the details, but that there he could understand how some people in the community might feel that the police officers might treat them unfairly, that police officers protested him at a funeral. And since then, Mayor de Blasio said nothing. I wonder if there's just such a powerful organization that, in a way, they're kind of untouchable.
Rick, thank you very much. And Mara, you wrote about exactly this in your piece in the Times the other day.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this is a problem that is especially bad in New York City, in which when things go wrong, we don't hold, or often don't hold, police officers accountable. The mayor likes to talk a lot about retraining the entire force, and he's certainly gotten the number of police stops down, and that's all well and good. But holding people accountable is the best way to send the message of what is and what is not acceptable. And, you know, all the data shows, for example, officers are still out there using chokeholds, and yet they're rarely held accountable. A lot of the officers who receive recommendations for, disciplinary recommendations from the Civilian Complaint Review Board never actually get that discipline from the department itself. And I think the history of the NYPD in New York, you have the nation's largest police union, you have a police force that I think has been given the credit, understandably, right, of turning around what was a once very high crime rate into what is considered this national miracle of the safest large city in the country. And then you also have a force that received the accolades, and rightly so, as did the FDNY after the September 11th tragedy. So they're seen as kind of above reproach. And I think that contributes to an environment of impunity. And I think that, from Mayor Bloomberg to Giuliani and now de Blasio, these mayors have been very wary of the power that the police department holds in the city's politics. That may be changing, but this case is an example of the cost of that, the human cost of what happens when you don't hold people accountable.
We're talking about the testimony so far and the departmental trial of Officer Daniel Pantaleo and the death of Eric Garner on Staten Island in 2014 with Mara Gay, New York Times editorial board member, and Phil Stinson, professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He is a police misconduct expert. And Kenny in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kenny.
Good morning. Good morning to you and your guests. I'd just like to ask, during the grand jury testimony, did any of this revelation that we're talking about now, in terms of the show code and testimony and the Emmy report and anything else, get into the grand jury testimony for this officer? And in saying that, the training of these police officers, when somebody has a medical condition and they do say, "I can't breathe," depend on a heart attack or whatever, don't handcuff them. But I noticed that the police department tell these officers to keep doing your job, no matter what you say. So if I can't breathe, you're still going to get handcuffed. And if I remember years ago, somebody was handcuffed and died, and the ME said the way his hands was tied behind his back made it detrimental to him to breathe. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kenny. Call us again. Professor Stinson, there's a couple of points there that Kenny raises. One is whether these revelations that are coming out in the departmental trial, the ones we've been talking about from the medical examiner, from the head of recruit training, this text message that made people in the courtroom gasp, not a big deal, from the commander, would these have been presented to the grand jury that considered charges against Officer Pantaleo and dismissed as not rising to the level of criminal activity? Would they have been presented, for that matter, to the U.S. Justice Department, which is considering, I guess, civil rights violation potential charges against any of the officers involved? Is there a way to know for you as a police misconduct expert?
Well, it's difficult to say in this case, but I can tell you that prosecutors can present anything they want to a grand jury. And the old adage is that a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich, meaning anything a prosecutor presents will result in an indictment
if
the prosecutor really wants an indictment, if they want to. So, you know, it's difficult to say in this case. I don't know the specifics in terms of what was presented to grand juries, but we do know that the officer was not indicted. You mentioned earlier, you know, this is the latest in a push for justice in this case, and I would beg to differ to the extent that I don't think police department disciplinary process can result in justice that's going to satisfy much of anyone. And certainly that's going to be a problem here. But we are, again, learning a lot more that's become public at this point. But it's awfully late. It's almost 5 years since Eric Garner was killed.
Yeah, I mean, I think I couldn't agree more. This is too little too late, but there's value in this trial because of what we are learning. I think the most upsetting thing is, and I honestly can't remember how much of what was presented to the grand jury in 2014, 5 years ago now, was public. But I do know that the revelations that we're discussing here today have never been released to the public. And so there's value in that. It's depressing because the gulf between what the public knew and what the NYPD and ostensibly the mayor knew is pretty vast here, and it's pretty damning. I think the idea that the mayor and the police commissioner, both of them, Bratton and now O'Neill, have been aware of the details, the gory details of how the death occurred and did nothing, essentially, for 5 years and were comfortable doing nothing, is, I think the mayor owes the city some answers.
What's the range, Mara, of possible disciplinary action after this trial is completed? Because Pantaleo is still on the force all these years, getting paid. I understand that his pay actually went up in the year after Garner's death, even though he was taken off the beat and put, or taken out of the field and put on desk duty. Somehow he racked up more overtime, from what I read, and got paid more the next year. But what's the range of disciplinary actions depending on what the Civilian Complaint Review Board trial finds and the recommendations?
Right. So Sally Goldenberg of Politico actually did a piece a couple years ago about how he got a 35% increase in pay the year after Eric Garner was killed. The range, I mean, this could range anywhere from a loss of vacation days to modified duty to, which he's already on, to being fired. And I think anything less than, in my opinion, you know, being fired would be not enough. I think there are also some questions about some of the other officers and supervisors who were involved. And, you know, Lieutenant Bannon, for example, who is the one who sent that text message and who oversaw this operation, one of the folks who did. There are some questions about whether they should also see disciplinary charges, I would say.
And Mara, what about the other officers at the scene in particular? Because I've always wondered why the focus has been solely on Officer Pantaleo, who took him down with that chokehold, if it was a chokehold, but others at the scene were also holding him down while he was saying, "I can't breathe." It was really once he was on the ground that he was going, "I can't breathe," 11 times, and it wasn't Pantaleo or just Pantaleo who were pressing him against the ground during that.
Not at all. I mean, I have trouble with that. I'm not a lawyer, though, so maybe there's something there that I don't understand. But it seems like there were a lot of people to blame in this situation. And it's not clear why Officer Pantaleo is the only person being looked at here. But actually, yeah, I really don't know. I mean, that's a question I've wondered about myself.
Yeah. Phil, you know, to the extent that there's sympathy for the police officer here, the defense that rings with many people is he was doing his job. He wasn't out to hurt or kill Eric Garner. The officer and his defense team say Garner was resisting arrest. He was a well over 300-pound, really big guy. And so Officer Pantaleo did what he needed to do to subdue him, resisting arrest, and then the fact that he was, as the defense describes him, morbidly obese, contributed to his death. So how does that all look to you, considering that apparently the grand jury saw it that way, and there are many New Yorkers who won't, but there are many New Yorkers who will also see it that way?
Well, I think there are some good points there. I certainly can tell you, you know, I was a police officer for several years, a very long time ago now when I was a young man, and I can remember instances where trying to handcuff somebody who was resisting, that they would say something along the lines of, I'm having trouble breathing or something like that. And sometimes when, a police officer then lets them up and it doesn't finish handcuffing them, the fight's on again. So, you know, there's something to be said for that. I think a police officer's view is they're going to finish handcuffing him, and then he will be able to be set up and hopefully breathing easier at that point. But, you know, I'm asked often what the purpose of my research is. Some people seem to think that it's anti-policing or something, and it's not. The main purpose of our research is to improve policing. And I think if anything comes of this disciplinary trial, the public parts of it, is that maybe we can improve policing, not only with the NYPD, but at the thousands and thousands of law enforcement agencies across the country. And if that happens, that's a good thing.
Mara, you've been focusing on the mayor in some of your responses and the responsibility that he has to at least give more explanations to the city.
Yes.
He, as we all know, is now running for president. How do you think those two things intersect with each other? Do you think, people have been raising questions about the possible impact on New York of him running for mayor, mostly in the context of whether he'll pay enough attention to the day-to-day running of the city. But one could also ask, well, if he gets some kind of controversial ruling, or whatever the ruling is, from the Civilian Complaint Review Board trial in this explosive and certainly nationally known case, that there could be political imperatives that color his response.
Yeah, you know, I think about this question maybe more than is healthy, but I think that the mayor ran for office in New York City in 2013, promising to hold the police accountable and to change the way they do business in New York City. He did so, making it clear to the people of New York with a brilliant campaign ad that his son is Black, is biracial, and that he understood the cost of stop and frisk. He was elected really only because of the support he got in the Black community in New York City. And yet he also, from very early on, I think, got very gun-shy about actually holding police accountable, in part because of course, that visceral moment in which the officers were turning their backs on him at the funeral of two police officers. And so he really hasn't challenged them in any major way.
Although he would
since
talk,
then.
He's spoken many times on this show and elsewhere about how many thousands and thousands of fewer arrests there are and fewer just stops and contacts with the police that people have as a result of his policies.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the story. But unless you're holding people accountable, you're not actually going all the way and doing what you need to do. And, the stops also precipitously fell, as you know, Brian, actually during the Bloomberg administration. That's when the sharpest decrease took place. But I think
Under court order, right?
Under court order. Let's absolutely. And Bloomberg is the one who actually brought them up. So I don't want to give him credit here.
And de Blasio is running on doing it voluntarily.
Absolutely. I just think that, listen, I think that the mayor has gotten lots of, has seen a lot of political benefits from running as a reformer and as a progressive who's going to bring accountability to the police, and that he hasn't delivered on it.
Phil, as a last word from you, again, as a criminologist and police misconduct expert in academia out there in Ohio, how does New York City, how does the NYPD look to you in national context Is it a model of good policing? You know, what the mayor is saying out there on the presidential campaign trail is safest big city in America while eliminating old-style stop and frisk.
Well, there have been a lot of good things with the NYPD and their policies in terms of reducing crime over the last three or four decades. However, I would draw the distinction by saying that the NYPD is like no other local law enforcement agency across the country. They have more than 40,000 sworn officers employed by the NYPD. It's like nothing else. If we take the NYPD out and then look at all the other agencies across the country, believe it or not, the average size in terms of employed sworn officers is just 34. And many, many agencies are much smaller than that across the country. So it's a very different agency and more dislike other agencies than like other agencies across the country.
Phil, I'm going to let you go. Phil Stinson, professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and a police misconduct expert. Thank you very much for joining this conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Enjoyed it.
And deep breath, everybody. Before we go to our next guest, who's going to be Scott Pelley from CBS News, we're going to change topics but hold Mara Gay from the New York Times editorial board over for a few minutes because Mara also follows and comments on the Trump investigations. And I want to note how consequential some developments just in the last few days have been, even though we haven't been covering them on the show. Maybe most consequential, a federal judge yesterday put the first legal stake in the ground for the right of Congress to issue subpoenas to the executive branch, ruling that Trump must turn over financial records that Congress requested because it is well within Congress's oversight authority to see them while it's investigating accusations of financial fraud made by Michael Cohen, among other things. At the same time, the New York Times revealed yesterday that five Deutsche Bank employees told the paper that the bank ignored indications of potential money laundering by Trump and his family members that were red flagged by a bank computer program, including transfers of money from Jared Kushner to Russians during and after the campaign that the computer had red flagged. We also have defiance of another subpoena today. This is a big deal in Washington this morning right now. Defiance of a subpoena by former White House counsel Don McGahn, who the president told not to testify, even about things that McGahn told Robert Mueller happened when McGahn was a private citizen, not a White House employee, that Mueller described as looking like obstruction of justice in the Mueller report. Now, maybe the court ruling yesterday about Congress's right to subpoena for oversight will set the stage for that defiance, the Trump-McGahn defiance, to also be overturned eventually. But also new yesterday was a more specific charge by Michael Cohen naming a Trump lawyer, Jay Sekulow, who Cohen says told him, Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Trump Tower Moscow negotiations. Also, a voicemail was revealed late last week from a Trump attorney to Michael Flynn's attorney asking for a heads up if Flynn implicated the president in Flynn's plea deal and hinting at a pardon if Flynn protected Trump from Mueller. And as if that's not enough, last night, Speaker Nancy Pelosi had a meeting with House Democrats in which the calls to open a formal impeachment hearing became more widespread. So, wow, that's a lot, and I'm even leaving a few things out. So coming on 2 months after the initial release of the Mueller report, Mara Gay, the story and new facts are not over.
Oh, no. It's only intensifying. I think the Democrats are probably right, I would say, to make sure that the American people have an actual opportunity to see the facts laid out before them. It's very different listening and watching someone testify than it is reading a report, a 400-page report that I think most Americans aren't going to read.
Well, that's why the Democrats want it, right? I mean, from a purely political standpoint, even if all McGahn, who was such a key witness for Mueller, or anyone else cited in the report, if all they did was come to Congress and say, with television cameras on, the exact words that were already published in the Mueller report, presumably the political impact would be different.
Right. I mean, I keep saying, and it's striking to me, if you remember several months ago when we watched the Kavanaugh hearing, the entire nation kind of stood still for hours and watched Brett Kavanaugh testify. you know, that is a very different effect than when the Mueller report landed and you have Bill Barr come out and say, oh, well, you know, no collusion. And so I think that is a dramatic difference. And the Democrats politically need that. But also, this is serious business. This shouldn't just be a partisan exercise. Congress, as a branch of government, should be using these subpoenas and these hearings and this testimony to hold the president accountable.
What do you make, just as a political analyst, of the pressure on Pelosi to start impeachment hearings over McGahn's defiance of the subpoena to testify today? Some people are seeing this thing today, Don McGahn not showing up, as what should be the trigger.
You know, it's difficult. I think that Nancy Pelosi is very smart and a strategist who has been building a case for impeachment, whether or not the Democrats actually pull the trigger on that. And that's the right move, I would say. I do think, though, that this question, the political question of how that would play out for the Democrats, is actually not resolved. I haven't seen any polling on this, but I'm not 100% certain that it would be a 2020 disaster for the Democrats to move forward with impeachment. It may be, it may not be. The conventional wisdom is that you're handing Trump the election if you move forward with impeachment. And I'm not convinced that's the case, if only because there's so few undecided voters in America.
Last thing, I didn't even mention in my rundown of recent days' developments, the Republican Congressman Justin Amash, who, yes, he's a maverick. Yes, he goes his own way on things. Yes, he supports Trump a lot, but he also doesn't support Trump a lot. He's become the first Republican to actually call for impeachment, and he has gone much further than almost any Democrat has gone in saying that the evidence is there that Trump committed impeachable obstruction.
Yeah, that was pretty remarkable. He managed to upset both sides of the aisle, which is probably a good thing.
How does that upset the Democrats?
Well, I think that, you know, for the Democrats, especially like Nancy Pelosi, who are gun shy about impeachment, they're not going to like being outdone, so to speak, by a Republican member of the House. But
do you think it puts actual additional pressure on Pelosi or Nadler to start an impeachment?
I actually do, only because the American people, most voters, don't understand that that member of Congress, Amash, is actually, you know, kind of not representative of the rest of the Republican Party. I think what they see is a Republican coming out ahead of the Democrats. More importantly, I would say that what he said yesterday, I believe on Twitter actually, was he laid out a roadmap for the rest of his Republican members and colleagues. And someone who can, you know, put country over party, hopefully. And that is, I may not agree with the congressman on everything, but I think he got this one right.
He was an original member of the Freedom Caucus.
That's right.
So we will see the implications of Justin Amash coming out the way he did. And obviously, to be continued on that topic, Mara Gay, member of the New York Times editorial board, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.